Okay, I know it's been a couple of weeks, but I really would like to finish off Ecclesiastes. In case I'm repetitious, you know, if I go into something I've gone through before, just let me know. But I do want to give a brief summary of what we've done until now. The main idea of the most important idea of Ecclesiastes, and this is really an idea of the entire Torah, and that is that, as we explained, the people misunderstand Ecclesiastes. They think he's asking questions against the religion, which he's not. He makes it quite clear, and if you know Hebrew, you will see that linguistically it is 100% correct that he endorses every one of the fundamental principles of the Torah, namely that the person that is just, God rewards, and that there is an afterlife. He has that in two places. He makes it very clear that he believes in these things, and he certainly, the Torah, believes in the Torah and the commandments, and this is interspersed throughout Ecclesiastes. To deny this is just simply to make a simplistic, to give a simplistic kind of interpretation which falls in line with the average person's way of thinking, which is not what King Solomon is all about. So if you look carefully at the verses, you'll see that he endorses the most fundamental principles of Torah, and he didn't have any doubts about it because he was he received the tradition, and it was only a few hundred years from Sinai at the time of King Solomon, and he knew the not that the length of time makes any difference, but I'm just mentioning that the fact is that he didn't have any questions about the facts of the religion. But the thing, and this is the point that most people do not understand, and that is in Torah, just the word of God is not enough. And I know that sounds like a non-religious statement, but that's really what Torah is all about. For Torah, the word of God itself is not enough. What do I mean by that? I mean that in Torah, the Torah engages in man the highest element of man, that is his mind. And even if God says something, but if man cannot understand it, it does not have much value for him. This we see if you look through the five books of Moses. For instance, when Abraham confronts God and asks God, he says, how can you do such a thing? How can you be unjust? And use an expression, chalila l'cha, means like in our language, in our vernacular, like, heaven forbid, how can this be? That you will destroy these cities. He had to understand God's justice. It wasn't good enough for him to say, well, God says it's just. Well, what's the problem? No, but if I don't understand it and if I have a problem, then there's no value in it to me. It's fine to know that God is right, but what has it helped me? It only helps me if I understand it, if my mind comprehends it. And my life is a life of understanding, then I have a life as a human being. But just to say, well, God said it's right and it's right, that's not what Torah is all about. And that's why Moses also challenged God when he says to God, and if you don't do this, then wipe me out of the book that you've written. Don't put my name there. Which means when man speaks to God, it must be in his own framework, with his own understanding. And if there's no understanding, there's no value. That's where Torah differs from all man-made religions. Man-made religions just want one thing. They want salvation, they want the hereafter, they want the eternal, and they want to appease God, and that's basically the fundamental principle of idolatry, is to propitiate the gods. And that's it. They want a guarantee for the good. That's not what Torah is all about. Torah is a religion of mind, of understanding, and if you don't have any understanding, then there's no value in your life. And this is the premise with which King Solomon, his whole book is based upon this premise. And because at the end of the book he says, keep all the mitzvahs and that's it. So he knew the mitzvahs were correct, so what does he have to have the whole book for? Okay? And this was the problem that I raised when I first started, which I would like to answer today. You know, why does he in the end say, well, the end of all things is that everything has been heard, and okay, now just keep God's commandments. But that would seem to be a contradiction to the whole book, because now we're saying the whole purpose of the book is that man cannot live with that idea alone. Even if he knows that God tells him to do X, Y, Z, but just doing that is not going to give him a life of a human being, because your life of a human being must be based upon your mind and your knowledge, that is man. The essence of man, which is the Tzelem Elokim, the divine element of man, all the scholars of our Torah say it means man's intellect, his knowledge, his understanding. That's what differentiates man from the animal kingdom. And that's what's unique in man, and that is not a product of any kind of evolutionary process, but that is something which God directly implanted in man. The human soul is the ability to understand, to comprehend, to gain knowledge of everything that is around him. Now, that's why, but Solomon's premise, that's Solomon's premise, and he uses this premise when he approaches every lifestyle. And that's why King Solomon is not afraid to approach lifestyles that have nothing to do with the lifestyle that the Torah prescribes. For instance, some of the lifestyles, and I mentioned this, if you really look through the book carefully, and I agree it's a difficult book, because it's written by the wisest of men, King Solomon, and of course if a wise person writes something, it's difficult to decipher. It takes much time to learn and to study. We're fortunate we have the guide of the scholars of the Torah that had the tradition of the ideas carried down from the time of King Solomon. So we do have some kind of a clue and some kind of an insight. We're fortunate with that. But still, it's a very, very difficult project to really understand everything he's saying. It's also written in a way, the way, as King Solomon himself says in Proverbs, the way the wise write, they always conceal the ideas. You have to really look carefully to pull them out. But they are there. Now, the different lifestyles that he goes through every conceivable lifestyle that a human being can have or could want. He goes through the lifestyle of the empire builder, that the lifestyle of the successful, accomplished individual. He shows that that has no basis in reality. He shows that the lifestyle of the playboy has no basis, that leads to unhappiness. He even has the religious lifestyle, and he shows how frustrating that is. And he has that on two counts. He has the religious lifestyle in terms of a person that would like to be like a monk, you know, just live an ascetic existence, walking around with a religious kind of feeling, that kind of a lifestyle, and he shows that that's frustrating for man, that man cannot be happy in such a life. And he also shows the person that lives with the idea that he's going to get paid back in the afterlife. That kind of a lifestyle is also a frustrating, unhappy lifestyle, and if it's frustrating and unhappy, it cannot be correct. That, by the way, is the premise of his book, namely that there must be a lifestyle for men that is satisfying as well as true. You see, that's, to place it succinctly, that's what he's saying. It's got to be true and it has to be satisfying. You cannot, if you're going to show me a lifestyle, even if you would show me a lifestyle that would be satisfying but not true, King Solomon would say, then that's not satisfying. Because man is essentially a mind, and if he knows that this is not true and not real, that itself would prevent him from enjoying it. Okay, so it must be two things. Then he goes through the lifestyle of the thinker, the great philosopher, the thinker, the college professor, the individual who is a man of knowledge. Is that lifestyle satisfying? And he breaks that one down as well. And he shows that that kind of a lifestyle, that people are attracted to that kind of a lifestyle because they feel that this person has some kind of a superiority and he's really an individual that is above all because he's in the world of knowledge. But then when he dies, just like an animal, then, or like a fool or like an animal, then that shatters that illusion as well. And he shows you how the life that we have is basically an illusion-shattering life. And every kind of lifestyle that you're attracted to, if you were really honest, you would see that there's a natural breakdown to that kind of a thing. And man finds himself in a world where he is totally insecure. Where he looks for a certain kind of a lifestyle to give him a security and a feeling that he has some kind of permanence and some kind of value. But the truth of the matter is there is no lifestyle out there like that. He also has the romantic lifestyle, the lifestyle of the lover. He has that too. He has every conceivable type of life that a person could be attracted to, and he shows that any one of those lives does not hold up if you're looking for a life of happiness for man. And the end of all those lifestyles is simply frustration and unhappiness. Okay. Now, the important thing to remember is that you have to understand that King Solomon is making a big statement here. But you'll ask, of course, well, what do you mean? We see some people say they're happy. So King Solomon would say that people say a lot of things, but we really cannot accept what they say. They say things for reasons. They say things because they want other people to think that they are true, essentially. They say things because they themselves want to believe those things are true. So King Solomon would never take as evidence a statement that a person, well, I'm a happy truck driver, you know what I mean? He doesn't believe what the person says. He has to analyze it logically, he doesn't accept anecdotal testimony, okay? That's an important point. By the way, Plato, Socrates said the exact same thing. He also, when he's discussing life, he mentions that you cannot believe a person who claims that he's happy or unhappy because there are different motivations that people have for making these statements. And oftentimes, they don't know themselves whether they're happy or unhappy, and it's simply a lie, but they want to fool themselves. So the only thing we could do in testing life is to use logic and reason, and that's exactly what he does. Rigorously goes through every type of lifestyle and shows why each one fails to give man an adequate existence, and you come to the conclusion that vanity of vanities, emptiness of emptinesses, which means that this human existence really is a worthless kind of existence, unhappy. And so you'll ask me, if that is the case, well, how come most people don't feel that way? The answer is that most people's lives are really the way most people live is not the way that King Solomon would consider a valid kind of existence. See, most people's lives are like a bob in the ocean. They go up, they go down. The wave comes, they're under, then they're up. And if you look carefully and you listen carefully to people, and today with the media, that's one good thing about the media. You have exposure to a lot of different people and different lifestyles, and you'll see people that you would think would be very happy. And you'll see when they talk about their depressions and their unhappiness, and they say, yeah, but then I get back on my feet, and they the way they handle life. And the strangest thing about it is that when you look at some people that are in total misery, you see they look just as happy sometimes as people you'd think would be on top of the world. I mean, this fellow, Chris, what's the last name? I forget his last name. The one who played Superman just got paralyzed from the first vertebrae down. I mean, they interviewed him, and you see the way he talks about life. You wonder, well, he doesn't seem that much worse off than he was when he had all his faculties. So and you look at that, you say, well, boy, I should be walking around all day happy. The fact that I'm not crippled, I'm not in his condition. And then you see people who have what you would think is everything, and yet you find that they're on drugs and drinking, and they simply can't make it through life. But the answer is, and that's exactly what King Solomon is getting at, the answer is that you cannot, that's why you cannot trust what people say about their lives. They disguise, they hide, they don't want to admit to different things. But the only way we can analyze life is in a logical way. And most people's lives, the way they make it through life, the question is, of course, King Solomon shows that every single lifestyle fails. So that being the case, they say, well, why isn't everybody walking around in depression? Okay, so you'll tell me that's partially true. I forgot what the rates are. 50% of people are in depression, whatever it is. But experience depression, that may be true. But the fact is that most people don't live with rationality. And that's why you might say, in a sense, that's where that statement, ignorance is bliss, comes from. Because most people go by the moment, as I mentioned before, like a bob in the ocean. You know, they're up and then they're down. But when they're down, you see, they never take into consideration the entire picture of their life. They just go through each stage in a very myopic, nearsighted way. So that kind of saves them, and because what happens is when they're in depression, they're very depressed, but then it passes over, and then they think, oh, now everything's going to be great. So they go into this elation. So they go from elation to depression, depression to elation, and they just make it through their 70 or 80 years that way, okay? Now, King Solomon, of course, would not be happy with such a kind of a thing. I mean, most would say, you know, that's why if you listen to the music, I mean, the culture of the society always contains, certain ideas. And if you're an intelligent person, you can really use it in a way that you can gain knowledge. I mean, according to Torah philosophy, culture, we don't have any culture in Torah. Culture is not a value, because culture is really the philosophy of the masses. That's why, strictly speaking, it may sound a bit shocking, but strictly speaking, according to Torah, one is not permitted to read literature, and the rabbis deduce it from the verse in Leviticus, where it says, "You shall not turn to the strange gods, the Elilim." So the Talmud says, "Well, why the word turn?" So the Talmud says that it means to say you shouldn't turn. See, the strange gods are something produced by man. That means the man-made illusions that are projected onto reality. They're not real, and the Torah is against anything that's not real. So the Talmud says it means don't turn towards anything that's man-made and is not real, which means literature. That's why literature really is, from a strict halachic sense, literature is prohibited based upon that verse. Why? Because in literature what you have is, you have a situation where you take average people and you present them as heroes. Now those heroes are not real heroes. They're gripping emotionally, but in reality they aren't heroes. Yet when you read them, or a movie for instance, would be the same thing as literature. There's no difference. How many times people go to a movie and they see a gangster being successful and then they feel upset when he gets caught? Now that means that this person has caught them emotionally and they think he's a hero. And when Al Capone finally gets caught, they're upset because he became the hero. So you see, a person can be attracted to a certain heroic figure either through literature or through a movie or through one of the cultural media. And that, the Torah says, is bad because this man isn't a hero. If you look at his life objectively, you see this man is a killer, a ruthless killer. But he could become your hero for a moment. Now, the Torah considers that to be wrong. That's why literature, which is man-made and where you have writers that are not really in line with the Torah philosophy, they set up these heroes, and you're emotionally caught up when you read these books. You're caught up and you identify with these figures. You understand, when you read literature, it has no value unless you can identify with the figures. Otherwise, there's no psychological value. Now, that identification, the Torah says, is bad, because you're identifying now with these people that are not really heroes, but your emotions are getting caught up, so now you're presenting for yourself a way of life which is false, but emotionally gripping. That's the Torah's worst danger. That's the whole idea of idolatry. So that's why the rabbis say that literature is prohibited. But the Torah, in its divine wisdom, has one kind of an exception to that, and that is that if you study it for the sake of knowledge, then it's permissible. In other words, the same literature that you read, if you take a piece of Shakespeare and you analyze it and you show why it is incorrect, why his ideas are false, and what is attractive about the idea, so then this is a good thing, and this is something the Torah does endorse. So that's why when my students ask me, allowed to watch a movie, I say it depends. If you're going to just allow your emotions to take over and watch the movie, then it certainly is prohibitive, because you're just indulging in a false world because it's gripping emotionally, and that's exactly the opposite of the whole Torah philosophy. But if you study it and you understand it and you make it a source of knowledge and understanding, then it is permissible, because the Torah says that you're not allowed to study the ways of the idolaters, but the Torah says you shall not learn to do as the idolaters do. So the rabbis say that's an important, those two words are very important. You shall not learn to do as they do. But you can learn their ways in order to understand what they do and understand the human mind, because that is something which will put you on the right road and which will give you insight and knowledge, which is really the end of the end product of the entire Torah. So there again, you have an important fundamental principle of Torah philosophy. Now, getting back to the point, and so that's why I mentioned that we today have access. You know, people always always put down the television, they put down, you know, today's literature. I'm not so quick to put it down. It depends. Unfortunately, the way it is used commonly, it is a bad thing, because what you're doing is you're getting people into nonsensical kinds of lifestyles, and man is groping for some kind of a way to live, but doesn't have the right way, and people get caught up in these incorrect lifestyles. But, is a corrupted value system, basically. But if you're an intelligent individual, you could use all the knowledge of the media and analyze it and really see what is correct and what is incorrect, and then it certainly is permissible, because now it's permissible, it's a part of life and a part of understanding, a part of knowledge. So today you have access to a lot of information that they didn't have in the past, and in a way it's good, in a way it's bad. It depends on the perceiver. You know, in Torah, the concept of the perceiver is the most important thing. It's not the source, it's the perceiver that makes the difference. As Rabbi Soloveitchik mentioned, it's the same God, but the prophets, the levels of prophecy are different. Moses was the highest prophet, qualitatively differentiated. Elijah was the greatest of the succeeding prophets. But the reason why each one differs is not because of the source. The source is always the same. The source is God. It's the perceiver that makes the difference, the level of the perceiver. So here again, and the question is the media good, modern media good, bad, or otherwise? It depends on the perceiver. That's what makes the difference. If it's a Torah personality analyzing life, then it's great. But if it's a person that's taken in by the emotions of the moment that these media present, then of course it's total destruction. So getting back to the Kohelet, to the Ecclesiastes, what he's saying is that most people's lives, the way they make it through life, they only make it through life because of the fact that they don't think about their whole life. All they do is they go through from day to day. Today they feel good, oh, life is great. Tomorrow they're depressed, oh, life is tragic. But they never stop to think. In a way, that saves them, because what Ecclesiastes is saying is if they did stop and think and look at one whole picture, they would get a very bad picture, and they would see that their life is really not worth living. And that could lead to total depression. Although most people are not capable of such a kind of depression. You see, the Torah differentiates between the emotions and the mind. There's a emotional depression, and then there's an intellectual depression. As a matter of fact, that's mentioned in Ecclesiastes, where he says that it's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of joyousness. He says, because the heart of the wise man is always in the house of mourning. Which means to say, the wise man who is looking for a whole picture. You see, the difference, and this is something that Maimonides mentions in one of his writings, that he was, when he was serving the Sultan, so he used to give him, he felt that as a physician, it's not just important to be the physical physician of the Sultan, but he believed that health, physical health, is very dependent upon the mental state. So he used to try to give the Sultan certain ideas of philosophy, philosophical ideas, to make him happier. I don't know how successful it was in that score. But one of the things he tells the Sultan is that the real life of a person should not have ups and downs. And this is one of the things he mentioned. A person's life should not have ups and downs. He says a wise man's life is always on an even keel, he calls it. An even keel. He says if a good thing happens, he's not too happy. Doesn't really change him too much. If a bad thing happens, also, he doesn't change much. He basically rides an even keel. And the reason is because his happiness is not associated with the events of the moment, as the ordinary person, but his happiness is dependent upon the total picture. And if a person has in his mind the total picture, he is aware of all the possible ups and downs. That's all factored into the equation of his understanding of life. And since that's the case, he doesn't go up and down like a bob in the ocean with every event. He has an even keel, okay? And that's what the Ecclesiastes, that's what King Solomon is looking for also. Because King Solomon maintains that even, of course, I mean, I know it must be something you're thinking of in the back of your mind to say, well, look, maybe we can enjoy those moments of elation. Why should we lose that? I mean, most people don't want to give up any kind of pleasure. And you say, well, look, in the life of the average person, there are moments when he has a tremendous high, and you're asking me to give up these highs, and you're saying that I should be on an even keel. A person doesn't like to give up anything. Even if I would say, well, those moments of the highs are very few, and it's not worth it. But still, a person is very attracted to pleasure and to enjoyment, and therefore it's very hard for them to give up even something which is momentary, and think, wow, that's great, because they're attracted like a magnet to that moment. That's the problem, really, of the fool, and that's the difference between the fool and the philosopher. The fool is fixed on the moment. All he can think about is that one moment. He can work for 20 years to get himself that house or that car, and the enjoyment is very momentary. He'll never think, well, look, was it worth all that effort? So he's fixated to the moment. But the truth of the matter is that King Solomon would argue that even that moment is not enjoyable. Why? Because a person, a human being, see, any form of existence, if you want it to be happy, happiness means you must satisfy its needs. So if you want to make a chimpanzee happy, you don't put him in a fancy hotel, you have to put him in a place where his needs are satisfied, which would mean he has trees, he has fruits, he has things that he enjoys, okay? But in order for the being, for the whatever it might be, whatever creature it might be, in order for it to have happiness, all the things that are a part of its nature that have needs must be satisfied, okay? Now, man is also a creature, and that's why in Torah, when we say the soul of man, we don't mean a mystical thing floating around in the sky like Christians do or other religions. It's not some kind of mystical element. The soul of man means his essence, what he is in reality. And what King Solomon is teaching us is that man in reality, intelligence is a part of his very self. So if you block out a part of that person and you say, well, that part should be not functioning now, then you cannot really be happy. You see, that's where the world makes a mistake in their philosophy. And you often say everybody is a philosopher whether they want to admit so or not. The fact is that a person must be a philosopher because a person does things out of volition. And if they do, they must be doing it because they think that it's right, in which case they have some kind of a philosophy. Now, the average person's philosophy is, well, look, I want to have a good time tonight, I'll get drunk. Well, what does it mean you'll get drunk? It means I'll bomb out one part of my nature, which is my mind, which is thinking too much, and therefore the other part of me will be able to have enjoyment and pleasure. So the person is fooled because they haven't a pleasure experience, but they think that this pleasure experience is happiness. What King Solomon is saying is that that is not true. A pleasure experience is a pleasure experience. It's not happiness. Why? Because a pleasure experience means a part of you had satisfaction. So if you get drunk and you get rid of your mind, then you won't think anymore. You won't think about your problems. So then another part of you will be able to have enjoyment. But this cannot be happiness, because happiness is only possible where the whole person is satisfied. Now, for the whole person to be satisfied, you cannot bomb his mind out, because a mind is an integral part of man. That's the essence of his nature. Everything that you see, just look at a city, where did that city come from? It didn't come from the man's instincts, it came from man's mind. So mind is an integral component of the human being, and you cannot conceive of happiness if you don't have that part active and being satisfied. So that's why King Solomon says that when he analyzes the lifestyles, one of the things he says, and happiness, what does it do? Which means to say it's a momentary thing, and it's something, a joyous occasion, a joyous experience really is just a momentary thing. His mind can't really enjoy it, so a part of him can't enjoy it, and it's something also which is temporary, so therefore, this is not the lifestyle that can give man happiness. What we're saying is that, and here again is the difference between an anecdotal kind of statement about happiness and a logical one. The only evidence King Solomon is going to accept, if we were there in his presence and giving him the argument, the only argument he's going to accept is not your statement that I had a great time, which is basically that the philosophy of the masses could probably be summed up in that one sentence. I had a great time. That's it. That's life. If you had a great time, it's life. What do you mean you had a great time? then already becomes problematic. How do you translate that into logical terms? But what we're showing is that the translation of that into logical terms is that a part of me was enjoying itself. That is not what King Solomon is saying. He's saying if you look at it logically, you see it was only a part of you, and another part was either defunct, put out of commission, or it was suffering. So this is not a happy experience. You cannot call this happiness. So there is a difference between conclusions that we draw when we analyze something with our mind. Analyzing your mind, you'll see this man was not happy. Yet the person experientially will think he is happy because he's making a mistake. He had an enjoyable experience and he's looking for happiness. He says, this is happiness, you see. So the mistake is, I often say that the reason why people can't find happiness, the main reason is because they think they know what it is and they're making a mistake. They think it is those moments when they're in elation. But when they're in elation, if they looked at it logically, they would see it's only a part of them that really is in elation. Another part is bombed out, or else it ceases to function, and the person doesn't want to think about it. That's one of the ideas that he mentions, by the way, where he says, I think most people don't understand this, but he says that there's a time for everything, a time for sowing, a time for reaping, a time for happiness, a time for sadness. What is he getting at over there? Everybody likes to quote that part of Ecclesiastes. They don't really understand what he's getting at. They think that he's saying something which is good. Actually, it's not. Actually, it's a part of his whole question on life. In other words, what he's saying is that most people's lives are really grounded in the temporal. Like, it's not a logical kind of thing. Like when a person's happy, he doesn't want to think about the sad part. So he just wipes that out of his mind. Now, according to King Solomon, once you do something like that, you can't truly be happy, because what you're doing is, in other words, that's the life of the person that's not on the even keel. In other words, the person that is just gripped in the moment. Now it's time to be happy, now it's time to be sad. But when the person is happy, if you think to himself, well, just a moment, how long is this happiness going to last? I have other problems and this and that. Then he's going to get very sad. So the only way he can be happy is by denying a certain aspect of reality which his mind tells him is so. Now the moment you do that, the moment you deny a part of reality that your mind tells you is so, you're stopping a part of yourself from working. Now that's conflict. Conflict cannot be happiness. So what King Solomon shows is that his demands for a life that's a worthwhile life has to be where the whole person is involved and his mind is happy too. That, he says, we can't find. He says that we think we find. Let's give you an example. I think it was last week, we had what I would call an ecclesiastical event, okay? You'll understand what I mean by, when I tell you what it is. There was a young, I'm sure you've all seen on the news, this skating couple from Russia. And the young man was a world famous, won awards many, many times over. And, they were the most famous skating couple in the world. And people were, if you listen carefully to the people that were commenting on the situation, saying, well, this was like a fairy tale existence they had. You know, I mean, I had a chuckle when I heard that, because it may look like fairy tale to you, but meantime, the man's back was in terrible shape, and the amount of work and effort that went into it, and his physical health was really impaired mechanically due to those, different types of things that are unnatural for the human body to do, which he was expert at doing. But of course, everybody looks, for them, it's fairy tale when they just see them on the ice, but they don't really see what goes into doing into a life like that is a very, very difficult, painful kind of existence. But most people, as I say, are very superficial, and they just see, oh, they have a fairy tale existence. But aside from that, suddenly he just died. He just died suddenly, and everybody was struck. How is this possible? This may, I mean, after all, you know, today is the aerobic. You see, people are always looking for something that's going to be their salvation. Today it's the aerobic salvation. In other words, if you're aerobically fit, then you're healthy, you're going to live forever, and there's no problems. And you see a person 28 years old, you're not going to be more aerobically fit than he was. I mean, these people are exercising 8-10 hours a day, and even more sometimes. And suddenly, he was snatched away in the prime of his life, in the midst of all his success. That's exactly what Ecclesiastes says in 9:12. Ecclesiastes 9:12. He says, "And also a person does not know his time, like fish that are caught in a bad trap, or like birds that are caught in a snare." He says, "Just like them, people are. People are to be compared to them." He says, "When a bad time occurs, and it falls upon them suddenly." And as Rabbi Soloveitchik one time said, the main word in that verse is the last word, suddenly. That was exactly what happened to this skater. In the midst of the prime of his success, and suddenly he is gone, snatched away. Now, how do people handle something like that? This is what King Solomon is saying. How do you handle that? Now, most people say, well, it's not going to happen to me. Maybe for a moment they're shaking. They'll say, oh, that can happen to anybody. But after a while, they say, well, I eat properly, and I exercise, and I do this, and I do that, and my heart is okay, and I don't have a congenital heart defect, and this and that. It's not going to happen to me, you see. Of course, we know when we think about it that that's ridiculous, because you really cannot know what's going to happen. You can, even if you would be able to know physically what's going on inside yourself, which itself is impossible, at least at this point in our knowledge, but even if you could know that, you could still get killed by an accident, a car accident, or any other kind of untoward event that can come along and take a person's life. But people protect themselves against these thoughts with the idea that somehow or other, people do not say, well, that's rare. People don't usually say that. That's not enough, because rare is still scary. Maybe you're the rare one, you know? It's like somebody said, when it's, the 3% of the statistics is always very important to the 3% of the people. If you're in that 3%, that's 100% bad. So most people would not be satisfied with that. They have to build a wall around that kind of reality and somehow or other say, it's not going to happen to me. Now, here again is where King Solomon would say, but by doing that, you see what you're doing? That means that there's a part of your mind that's giving you information and you're constantly blocking that information off. That means that you are in conflict. Now, in conflict, you can't be in happiness. Happiness must be some situation where you're not in conflict. So that's why King Solomon mentions this fact. He says, but this is true, that a person can get snatched away in the prime of his career, just when all the person is looking forward to, or they're in the midst of their greatest fantasy of success, and boom, it's gone. Now, how could a person even enjoy success when they know that tomorrow may be gone? If a person wouldn't block that thought out, the person would never experience any kind of happiness. So there King Solomon, with that one statement, shows how from another aspect, human life, it's impossible for a person to be happy unless he blocks out a part of his mind. Blocks out a part of his mind, he's in conflict. In conflict, he can't be happy. So the argument that King Solomon presents is simply logic, from a logical standpoint, is undeniable. And that's really, that's basically his approach throughout the text. That's the underlying thesis of his entire presentation. But as I said, he goes through every lifestyle and shows each lifestyle where its vulnerability is. That's really the genius of Solomon's presentation, his philosophical presentation in Ecclesiastes. Let me stop here for a moment now, and I know that David had a question.
Okay. All right. Here's the thing that I would ask. What would be your way of bringing, say, the masses or groups of people to that level of understanding that they have to understand themselves? Let me give an example. See, most people are concerned with making a living, supply, and I'm not talking about just getting rich. I'm just talking about the basic essentials of food, shelter, clothing, whether it's getting the kids through school and keeping healthy. How do you get them involved in this world of ideas that you're talking about there?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's kind of a catch-22. Because in order to get them involved in the world of ideas, there's got to be some kind of a grassroots interest, okay? But I think that most people do have that interest. Actually, I'm very optimistic. I think that most people do have an interest. Well, I'll tell you why, for a simple reason. Of course, most people, even though they may not think they're unhappy, they experience unhappiness, which is what was King Solomon is showing. That you may not think you're unhappy because you don't want to think that way. It's a terrible thing. You want to say, hey, I'm a happy guy, I got everything I want. But you are experiencing unhappiness. I remember recently I met a person who retired, and what happened was they were in business. They were thrown out of business due to competition from abroad, but fortunately they had a lot of real estate, and they just cashed in the real estate. And this fellow told me, he says, Rabbi, I worked like a donkey for 28 years. And he's in his 50s now, and he was in his father's business. It was a successful business. The business closed down. He cashed in on the real estate. And I said, well, what are you doing now? And now I'm retired. He's a young fellow, and he's relatively young, in his 50s. And I said, well, are you happy now? He says, if I'm not happy, he says, who will be happy? I have my health. I have money. I have a family. I have everything anybody wants. But after speaking to him for a while, he told me that the main thing, he says, for me is to get through the day. He says, because I have nothing to do. So what this fellow does is he walks on the boardwalk for 3 hours every day, a total of 11 miles, and he starts at about 12, finishes around 3, and he says he has to go out to eat breakfast, which he only eats a muffin and coffee because he wants to stay healthy and continue to enjoy this wonderful life he has. So he says, but he has to eat out because he says otherwise he'd have no motivation to get out of bed and go doing something because he has nothing to do, basically. So he makes these artificial, he made for himself, actually, an artificial kind of need so that he can have a motivation to get out of bed, then to go through his walking, and then he comes home and tries to kill more time. Say, I watch this show, I kill more time this way, Rabbi, I kill that. By the time I turn around, it's dinner time already. Now, after it became quite clear to me that for this man, he doesn't think he's unhappy, but every moment of his day is really a struggle. He has nothing to live for, and he's just trying to live for life itself, which is the most absurd kind of thing that a person can do. On the contrary, every moment he's just waiting to kill time. It's such a sad thing to hear when a person says, I want to kill time. That means that they're just trying to get through life. They might as well be dead now. So there's no purpose in their existence. But, of course, they don't think that way. If you ask them, well, of course I'm happy. Because a person does not want to admit that they are unhappy because it's too tragic and they wouldn't be able to face the consequences. So most people just deny it. But most people, as I said, do experience, I mean all people, not most, all people, experience unhappiness, and that is the one thing that you have to work with. If you want a person, because of, that's why I think people turn towards religion, or they turn towards whatever it might be, whatever panacea the current fad is trying to, why do you always have these fads? I mean, actually, you know, the exercise fad, if you look back in history, you see 100 years ago, they had the same exact thing, where the exercise people were walking hundreds of miles, all kinds of crazy things, and they were convinced that exercise is the panacea. But then these things pass by, because they can see this one exercised and he died, and this one, you know, these things don't work, and then the cycle, you know, it's a cycle, basically. It may not be exactly identical, but it's like one of King Solomon's cycles, you know, and what happens is, you know, you always forget what happened 100 years ago, and they go through the same kind of trying to find the panacea for life. But the one thing that we have in our favor, that man has in his favor, and that is, that's the good thing is that he, you know, the funny thing, the rabbis say on the verse that, where it says, God saw all was good, so there's a rabbinical, there's a midrash on that that says, what does it mean, all is good? It means death. The day of death is good. So, of course, what does it mean the day of death is good? Everybody looks at it as bad. But the truth of the matter is, what the rabbis are saying is that death is a good thing because everybody knows they're going to die, and that sort of puts a damper on the whole fantasy and illusion of great success. And that's what King Solomon really says in Ecclesiastes, that you know that death itself is something which cannot be spoken away, you cannot overcome it, and if you really thought about it, you'd have very little motivation to live, but you block it out. Again, you get yourself in a conflict, and you think that you're happy when you're really in conflict. So the one thing we have going for us is the fact that you do have death, and that you do have the fact that life itself cannot really be satisfying. Because people are unhappy, that can always be used to get people's interest and to show them that health can only be a means. But what are you healthy for? You can't say, well, I'm going to just sit back today and enjoy my health. I'm enjoying my health for the next 2 years. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Health is a means. There has got to be something in life more than health. And the things that the mistake that people make, as the Rambam, Maimonides summarizes very easily. He says the mistake of people can be summarized in the following manner. He says people are taking accidents and they're making them into essences. Now what he means is like this. An essence means a purpose, an objective. The mistake that people make in life is they take the means and they want to make it into the end goal. Money is a means. Money is not an end goal. But what do people do? They make it into an end goal. That's it. I'll become wealthy. And what happens when they become wealthy? Then they suddenly are faced with the emptiness and the realization that you just can't have satisfaction from money. As I think it was one comedian one time said, he said the only, he was saying it in a serious way, comedians have a certain insight also, because that's why they're so funny, because they do have certain insight. He says the only thing that money can give you is that you don't have to worry about money. It can't really give you anything else. So actually, I always say that with money, you could either do one of three things. Either you could show off, that would be number one priority for most people on the list. Number two would be buy things that you don't really need. And number three is just be satisfied with the fact that you don't have any money problem, which is correct. But people take things that are only means, and they try to make them into an end goal, into an essence. It's an accident. An accident in philosophy means something which is non-essential. So they're taking accidents, as Maimonides says, and they're mistaking them for essences. So that is done. Oh, health is a means. You can't say health is only a means for life. Health can't be a goal, but people try to make that into a goal. The reason is because they have no real goals. Since they have no real goals and they don't want to admit they have no real goals, what they do is they have to feel they have something. They take anything in sight that they think is good and they place it up there as a goal. Okay? So this is really the mistaken philosophy of the everyday man, the common man, a family. A family, if you take a look at it, I would say that that's another one of the illusions of the modern-day ecclesiastical illusion, is the family. The main thing is to have a good family. Now, the truth of the matter is, a good family is a wonderful thing, but that you can't live for a family. A family is a nice thing to have, wonderful thing to have. That's not the essence of man's existence, and that's why it just simply doesn't work. That's why you see again and again it does not work. They have a good family, but then suddenly the husband gets a roving eye, there's a rebellion, the child rebels against the parent, and they have all these various problems, and the fantasy of the kind of family that the father wants is not what the son wants, the wife has a different kind of idea, and the strife and the struggle, and finally they say, well, we're working through our problems, we're working through. The point is the whole thing is a mistake, because what they're trying to do is take something which God gave to man as a means. A family is a means. They have a good family, then it's a wonderful thing. Like the rabbis say, the Talmud says there are things that they call them that relax a person's mind. If a person has a good family, if a person has is financially well off, these are things that give you a certain sense of relaxation. But it's only a means. If you try to make it into an end, it's going to fail. It has to fail, first of all, because you're demanding too much from that thing, and that thing can't give you that much. It's like if a person wants to take a ride in a car, and he wants it to be a plane, but it's not a plane. It just doesn't work that way. You're going to be unhappy if you think that way. And the same thing is true with all those things. With romantic love. Romantic love is a wonderful thing, but it's only a means. That's not the purpose of a person's life. Person's life is not. Person isn't made to have a. That his essence is to be in love. Love is a nice thing; it has its place, but it's also a means. It's a part of the relationship between man and woman, which really is supposed to be an intellectual experience, where man has a certain kind of way of thinking about reality, and woman has a different kind of way of thinking about reality, and both components together comprise one entity of man. That is where you have a satisfying situation for man, but not the romantic itself. The romantic is only a platform; it's only a means. So that's what Ecclesiastes is showing. But the way that we could reach people is through the fact that most people know that they are unhappy. they experience it. They may not readily admit it, but they do experience it, and that's why if you can open up that, you have a little bit of an opening there. If you could just broaden that, that's the area that you could really expand upon and produce a person who evokes interest into understanding life. That's what basically Torah is the understanding of life and the proper and the correct lifestyle. And we have these fantastic guidelines that were given to us by God. And once you understand them and you see them, you realize that how fortunate you are if you do have them. But people are looking for it. There's no question about it. Because they're unhappy. Because they know that they have to face death. Because they know all the things that Ecclesiastes talks about. Ecclesiastes is the most fantastic philosophical work because, as I said before, what it does is it's a combination. This is where the Torah is unique. It's a combination of psychology and philosophy. According to Torah, philosophy and psychology cannot be separated. They are not two sciences like they say they are in the universities. That's a big mistake. The universities are wrong. They are one science. You can't have one without the other. So this combination is what King Solomon, is the way King Solomon sets it up. Now, does that answer the question?
Well.
Listen, if I'm going too long, you can interrupt me.
See, the point that I would make in this whole overall picture is that, I would take, for example, the guy that you talk about that walks the boardwalk.
Okay.
That if he had proper motivation, that at this time in his life, he could spend his time to learning and sharing what he's learned.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, he is not motivated. He doesn't have the proper motivation.
Well, let me explain that. I'll explain that with a verse from Ecclesiastes again.
Okay.
It is amazing. I mean, when you really study it and restudy it and restudy it again. You know, the Talmud says that there's no comparison between a person that studies something 100 times and 101 times. And what they mean to say is that you would think that the difference in 100 and 101 is very slight, but it's not. Because in learning, the more you study, the more you see, the more you see. And I've gone over Ecclesiastes, I don't know how many times, but every time I go over it, I always see new ideas. At any rate, the quote from Ecclesiastes says in the beginning, he says, there are mistakes that you cannot correct, okay? That's another illusion that he's referring to, that people always say, well, it's never too late. You know, now that is a very... See, in our society, people always like to say things that are in line with fantasy. Like, there's nothing you can't do. I mean, there's nothing you can't do is ridiculous. Reality shows you there's plenty you can't do, and it's not a good thing for a person to think there's nothing you can't do, because then he's going to try to do stupid things that don't make any sense, and he's going to go above what he can do, and he's going to fail. But, of course, then they tell you, well, now you're down in the dumps. Soon things will be great. So the one philosophy, one false philosophy is built on another false philosophy. But this idea that it's never too late is wrong. And that's what King Solomon is saying. He says there are mistakes that you cannot correct. There are mistakes that you can correct, but there are mistakes you cannot correct. And one of the mistakes that you cannot correct is how you spent your youth, okay? That is a difficult one to correct, okay, if not impossible. That's why he states, King Solomon states in the end of Ecclesiastes, he says, remember your God in your youth, he says. Why? Because if you study Torah in your youth, if you remember God and you search for God in your youth, which means studying the whole approach of Torah, and you live the philosophy of Torah, then you will have it in your old age. But if you miss that period of life of your youth, it is almost impossible, if not impossible in many situations, actually impossible to correct that. Now, this individual, I did speak to him about that possibility, but the point is, his mind hadn't been used. He's in his mid-50s. He never used his mind. To start at that age, to use your mind in a way in which it's going to be really, really enjoyable, satisfying, is many, many times impossible. I won't say all the time, but I would say many times it's actually impossible. And I mean, I do see people.
All right, let me see. What I'm saying is that in the pursuit of living, that you have to establish those basic necessities. And I think if you can instill the ideas of learning and the importance of learning, that when a person gets older, and in the case of this individual, are in the case when your children are out of the house and through college or whatever.
Right.
Then a person, if he has that desire, if it's been embedded from his youth up, remembering the Creator in the day of your youth, that when he gets older, that then he should really get on a fast track.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's the point that I'm making.
Well, that's a very good point, and I would say even if a person had used their mind when they were younger, they didn't. You see, there are parts of life. It's true. I mean, the later part of life can really be the most enjoyable, the greatest part of life. That which people are afraid of, old age. Everybody's afraid of old age. The reason why they're afraid of old age is because they're basically hedonists, and their enjoyments are all physical. And when they get older, those things are definitely gone, like King Solomon describes it in the last chapter, about how each part of the person starts to deteriorate. And he gives an example of like a city, but he means that example, that's a mushel, that's a parable, which really means the human body. And the rabbis explain each part of the body, very interesting, how the person just deteriorates. And he shows that if a person did not engage in thought and in ideas in their youth, then they just face what most people do face in this country, a process of deterioration. Then they start getting into ways to try to avoid it through facelifts and all these operations and just trying to get out of it. But the truth of the matter is it's a futile effort, and the end is their life becomes a worthless existence. Whereas according to Torah, the highest praise that the Torah has for an individual is the word zakein, which means... Literally, it means old, but the rabbis say it means wise. It means the wise people. We can call a person a zaken if he's 18 years old, if he has knowledge. So if a person's life is geared towards knowledge, and that's what Ecclesiastes says in the end, actually. He actually almost says it outright, that if a person remembers God in his youth, and he will not face those days in which he will say there's no hope to live. And that's exactly what he says. He says, remember God in your early youth so that you won't reach those days which your existence becomes worthless. And that is absolutely correct. That's one of his concepts. But you must do it in your youth. In other words, I'm not saying that a person, this doesn't mean, when he says remember God, by the way, it does not mean, he doesn't mean what most people call the religious lifestyle. Most of the religious lifestyle is usually idolatrous. But what he means is that a person should live in line with a life of Torah.
You got a minute, Rabbi.
Okay. Which means a life of wisdom and knowledge. Now, a person, even if a person did not know what that lifestyle was, but if their mind was active and they used their mind, they used their intelligence, and then when they reach old age, they could redirect it towards Torah. But if a person never really used their minds at all, it is, as I said, many times impossible to correct that. And unfortunately, as King Solomon says, there are mistakes that one cannot correct, and it is sometimes too late. Okay, on that note, we'll end.